time opening.
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin. Turn down for what?
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. That sound can only mean another parkour dissection.
Another one.
I don't think we've ever done one yet, though.
Under the skin.
Okay, yeah. That's definitely parkour. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. It is the fearless duo of Phil Svitek and Dimitri Panos.
Hello, movie fans.
I love Dimitri rocking out to this music.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
We are, of course, doing Brick Mansions, the last completed film by Paul Walker. And we'll, of course, be talking a lot about that. So much to discuss today. Dimitri, what was overall thoughts on this movie?
It was an entertaining movie. It was mercifully short. It was, I respect it and appreciated it for its brevity, 90 minutes in and out. What it lacked in plot certainly made up for in action and parkour or free running, whatever you want to call it. There was a point in the movie where I was like, wait, what's going on? Like, this is, and then I was like, why am I just stop and just watch the movie and let it play out and, have a good time. And that's basically it for what it is. It's a fine action movie that falls under the Luc Besson, his stable of these transporter-ish, taken kind of movies, and some are better than others, and this one is better than, say, Next 3 Day or 3 Days to Kill.
For me, I enjoyed it. I had seen District 13 way back when, and I saw it in French with subtitles and whatever else. So I enjoyed that, and I was familiar with that style, and so I knew going into it what it was going to be overall. Mm-hmm. And is it the greatest cinematic movie that I've experienced? No, but it's, for me, I enjoy that. I know what I'm getting into, and I'm just in it for the ride. I know I'm going to get certain stereotypes in order to make the plot, in order to hit 90 minutes for this type of movie, we need to hit some stereotypes. Right. I'm fine by it. Let's just move on. And, you're going to get the cheesy lines, Dimitri's favorite line of the movie.
Oh, my favorite. Oh, it ain't rocket science. You don't need to be a rocket scientist. All you need is a rocket. And I'm like, that. And it was right there. I was like, yep, this is the movie I'm in for. And, I had another hour left after that line. So, no, I agree with you 100%. Once you start breaking this movie down, you could have a field day and be miserable, or you could look at it as Paul Walker's last fully filmed feature. And I will say, to watching it, it, especially at the end, there was a photo of him. Yeah. and in loving memory of, and it just brought about the tragedy of his loss. And, I'm sure we'll talk about Paul Walker a little later, but it's to a degree, I think, it's sad just the way he went. And it's hard to, you can't take pot shots and say, a lot of people, you just read a review before we hit press play about not a good way to go out, and it's like, oh, come on, lighten up.
I mean, for me, so I guess let's start with this. District 13 came out in 2003, French film. The only similarities, to be honest, between this movie and District 13 is the notion of separation.
Okay.
And the parkour element.
And although, David Bell?
And he David was in, Bell.
Okay.
And David Bell, of course. Other than that, this movie is story-wise, in that regard, is very much different, and also the style is very much different. Mm-hmm. In the sense of, I mean, here you go. You got the typical guy rolling in and, oh, what's that mean? You know what I mean? So yeah. There's already those types of differences. And then in District 13, a lot of it is more about the action and you know, I mean, there's a scene where they're, like, playing – I forget, it's like football, you know, where they're literally passing around the football, yeah. But they're on the rooftops mm-hmm. and whatever else. And so they're playing, imagine us playing football on the rooftops.
Sure.
And it's not rooftops like, you know, level rooftops, like, you know,
yeah, like rooftops and Mary Poppins.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're jumping, yeah.
In this movie, you had car chases as right. well. And you had elements of, you know, nuclear devices and things like that. So, you know, it broadened the scope a little bit with this mm-hmm. movie. So if I'm to kind of give a dissection of the main differences.
Sure. I mean, I don't remember. I can't say that I'd seen the movie in which this is a supposed remake of. So I was just going off of this, but it's tried and true. I mean, it's funny being that we just recently, too, talked about, say, RoboCop. Mm-hmm. There's a very similar plot line. Taken that to me, I'm going to say it was taken from RoboCop, where there's, you know, you got Detroit. Detroit really gets beat up on in movies.
Which, by the way, you know, the joke for a lot of audiences and critics is, you know, set in a dystopian Detroit. Well, I just call it Detroit.
Yeah, it's called Detroit. And, you know, but RoboCop had that where, you know, the corrupt people were trying to make this brand new city. It's going to bring Detroit back to its greatness. And here in this movie, we have the mayor, the governor, you know, he has his plan to tear down brick mansions and we're going to rebuild Detroit and bring it back to its glory. And so you had that similar plot line running through. And then it just, you know, you have a drug lord who's in there, but he's a drug lord only because of his environment. You know, he's not really a bad guy. He was forced to be a bad guy in order to live. And you know, he had all these tropes, I think you would say, it's like stereotypes
yeah.
that were brought up. But
again, I mean, I'll give him credit, you know, again, this is certainly not winning the Oscar for best original screenplay, but I'll give him credit where they tried to use certain stereotypes and then flip them by okay. the end, you know, especially with Liz's character, you know, as you were mentioning, the drug lord, it's because, as we learn, it's because of his environment, and you know, you knew right from the opening moments where, like, oh, I'll deal with those guys, you know, right. I have a plan for them. You're like, okay, well, you know, this board meeting, they might want a little more answers than that. They're like, oh, yeah. They'll take care of it.
Oh, I'll take
cheers
care of it.
Right. The champagne. So you knew from the get-go something was off,
right? And then they take a plot line right out of Michael Bay's The Rock. The yeah. Sean Connery movie, where in The Rock gets taken over by these militants and they have a rocket pointed to San Francisco. And we're going to wipe out San Francisco unless you pay a bazillion dollars. And here we have, you know, they commandeer a rocket and they get a bomb, a nuclear bomb or a nuclear device that, you know, we later come to find out was the whole intent anyways was to level brick mansions. So...
Which, if you learn nothing from this movie, it's that, you know, don't let it be coincidence. If you're thinking
my God.
Of stuff,
yeah.
It all came down to the zip code.
It all came down to a zip code. And it's like, if you're going to be that obvious, like, really? Like, you have four digits or however many digits, and those digits just happen to be the zip code of what Brick Mansions is. Like, don't make up something like the last four digits of the guy's phone number or... You know, you could have even gone the Spaceballs route and go 00000 something, but your zip code.
I mean, that was again. It's almost a parody of itself
yeah.
in some ways, and you just have to go along with that aspect of it and just be, you know, again, the zip code thing. All right.
Yeah, you just at that point again. That's an hour and 15 minutes into the movie, so you have 15 minutes more to go, and you're like, yeah, it's. You know, I've already been checked out about details and such. Again, I'm not going to say I didn't have a bad time. The movie didn't make me angry. It could have.
Dimitri's famous line.
Yeah, it didn't make me angry. But you know, like I said, Luc Besson's most recent stint with the Kevin Costner movie, 3 Days to Kill, like that movie made me angry. This one, you know, at least had some decent fight sequences. The car chases were fine, and you know, there's a little bit of style to it that I can say, okay, I appreciated that, and I didn't walk out angry. I said, okay, you know, it is what it is, and it's fine.
So let's talk about the development. You know, directed by I'm going to butcher this name.
Camille Delamare? Yes. Or Delamare? I don't know.
Editor turned director.
Yep.
Which is, you know, some people may say rare, but here's the thing. As an editor, you see everything, so it's not that much of a surprise to me that an editor could make a great director.
Well, I mean, I'll name two right off the top. Jan de Bont, editor, and he went on to direct a couple of small movies you may have heard of, Twister, Speed. Stuart Baird, another popular editor, and he went on to direct a Star Trek movie, Star Trek Nemesis and such. So, no, I mean, it almost makes sense where you can, you know, in times it makes sense where either a cinematographer or an editor, because they know how in their head they're piecing this together and they know what shots they're going
to
want.
I mean, editing's reverse engineering in the sense that you know what you need, and so you go to set, and in some sense you can literally shoot just what you need and right. possibly save a lot of money doing so. That's not to say experienced, you know, I'm sure the experienced directors, you know, well, the good ones certainly know how the principles of editing,
sure.
so they do that as well.
Yeah.
But.
Well, Kevin Smith, I think, edits his – Robert Rodriguez, I believe, edits his own movies, and he directs. So, yeah. You know,
and he shoots.
Sense.
I mean, he
and
does,
he shoots. Yeah, he does.
He writes his own music. He does everything for
That's
that.
That's true. He's a multi-hyphenate. You know, I looked her – obviously, I looked her up, and she's worked with Besson for a little bit, pretty much most of her career being Taken 2. Lockout, which I didn't see. Columbiana, that was a movie that made me angry. Transporter 3, which I was at Lionsgate, and we released that. So she was an editor in all those Luc Besson movies. So going in, I'm sure he said, hey, you know, he knows her style and probably just said, hey, you want to direct? I have this project. This seems like it would be good for you.
And I mean, his resume is just, it goes on and on and on.
You're talking Luc Besson?
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah.
You know, you got The Fifth Element, you got Leon the Professional, that's the Natalie Portman movie,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
when
yeah.
she's 13, I believe, Taxi,
yeah.
Kiss of the Dragon, and you know what the good news is, as I'm looking at it, Transporter 4, 5, and 6 announced.
Yes, and I think there's going to be a television series.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah,
that's definitely a lot.
But I mean,
but
you know,
he didn't solely write it. It's it was co-written by Bibi Nasseri.
Yeah,
who did District B-13? She's known for he or she is no. He's okay. So it's a he, and he's also actor and writer.
Right.
So that's I mean, we got a lot of interesting combinations on this movie just right off
yeah,
the bat.
And as a writer, I mean, he I think, I don't know, his movies to me of recent, you know, like I said, Columbiana was a movie that was just, it made me angry. He also directed the most recent Robert De Niro, Michelle Pfeiffer movie that came out last summer. I forget what movie that one was.
The Family.
The Family.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, the guy's had some hits in his past. But when he misses, man, he misses. You know, and I think people, too, still associate a lot of his career with The Professional and with the Bruce Willis...
Fifth Element.
The Fifth Element.
Which, you know, Fifth Element kind of, you know, in terms of him as a writer... And I could see in this movie, too, with Fifth Element, while action, there's also a lot of comedy.
Yes.
So, you know, and again, this one kind of, the comedy is very much different from the Fifth Element, but it has hints of that.
Yeah, and he had a part in La Femme Nikita as well. I mean, he's all over. He knows action. He has a certain style. And I'll call it sort of kind of like a, he's become almost like a B movie, you know, his movies to date, they aren't hugely budgeted movies. You know, he knows what he wants. They're usually in and out. you know, you, when you look at what he's done with, say, Liam Neeson's career or even Bruce Willis's career at the time of The Fifth Element and what he did. I mean, he brought Natalie Portman to screen and the actor who plays Leon has had a full career.
He was in the what I call the original Godzilla.
Yeah, which you call the original. Shame on you. shame on you. Yeah, he was in that. Yeah, I mean, Luc Besson has made, you know, he's had a great career. He's been around for a long time, and he continued. This is two movies within, I'm going to say, 3 months. We're in May. Mm-hmm. I think this is, he's released two movies within 3 months that he's produced and in one way, shape or form has had a hand in writing the movie and he farms it out. He has like this Camille, he has a team, you know, a stable to work from, like this Oliver Megaton is one of his favorites that he goes to, I think directed like Taken 2 and I think Columbiana, and he parcels out his projects. All his movies have very similar beats and style and the way that they're edited and cut and the way that they're told. And, you know, he swings for the fences. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I'm a big fan of Transporter. I was a big fan of Taken. I wasn't so much a big fan of Taken 2, you know. But he continues to make... you know, he just makes entertainment, and I think, again, I don't think he's looking for the Academy Award. I think he's just looking to entertain audiences, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Why don't we, you want to get into story elements?
Sure.
We'll have some fun here, and when I say fun, I mean, you know, not the poking type of fun at it, but I think, you know, we'll laugh here and there, but I found it interesting... In many ways, the way they set it up, because we don't really meet our protagonist until fairly late, if you kind of think about it. I mean, what is it, 15, maybe 20 minutes into the movie?
Well, I mean, it depends on who you think the protagonist is.
According to the movie poster, Paul Walker.
Okay. So, you know, I mean, he gets top billing, but is David Bell? I mean, it's always an interesting argument. About
but here's
who you're going to follow, and David Bell, who plays Nino, he's who we meet first.
Yeah,
and like you said, it's an interesting choice to bring Paul Walker about 15 minutes into the movie.
I mean,
and it's a mystery as to how at that point when he's introduced, how he's going to fit into all this.
Exactly, and knowing kind of you're already wondering, you know, to your point. Is he going to be a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Because they mention it that he's a cop, but is he part... You know, you're already wondering, is he corrupt
right.
or not?
Right.
And first off, you don't know right off the top if Leno is a good guy or not.
Oh, no. Yeah.
You see him with drugs and whatever else, and you're like, why is he cutting it open? And you know, in those early moments, it could be a selfish thing of, like, he's going to hide it. You don't know what he's going to do. He could hide it up as...
Well, yeah, and to your point, too, you can tell that he stole them. Like, yeah. You know, he obviously stole these, and was it a drug thing gone bad? And he, you know, he took them, and then, like, why is he... Again, I couldn't figure out, there's a toilet next to you. You chose the hardest way to get all that heroin or coke down a drain in a bathtub when you could have just flushed it down the toilet.
Well, he
but
also
anyways.
Put the liquids there.
Yeah.
To make it whatever non...
Sure. Toilet has liquid already. But in any case, I just...
No, but there was not just the liquid. He put the...
I thought it was Drano or something.
Yeah, something like
yeah.
that.
Anyway. But anyway,
I get what you're saying.
But yeah, I mean, you don't know. And you knew that he stole it. And then the question became, why is he destroying it? As these people are converging on him, who he obviously stole it from. And then you find out that he's... his reasons why he did it. And
that seemed to be the kind of primary thing. We always got an introduction and then we learned as we went along, because Paul Walker's character, and he's like, I got some police business to do.
Yes.
And then we see him, you know, talking with that posse, and K2 calls, and, you know, who gave K2 my number. And so he's kind of in, we're like, wait, is he part of some sort of mafia? And then, hey, I'm going to teach, you know, they go through the Asian man's laundry. We're literally laundering money here. You know, he's like, okay, cool. And so is he bad? Is he good? Where is this going?
Yeah. And, you know, and that it had also set up, if you want to call it sort of clever, I mean, it also sets up when we meet Nino, his first action scene, welcome to the world of parkour.
Yeah.
The way he escapes and all that. So we see the type of what he is suited to as far as in this world of action. We cut to Paul Walker's character as the cop. You know, we are introduced to his line of action, which is, you know, he's good with his gun. He can drive a car. He'll jump on top of a car. He may not have the finesse of a parkour artist or person. So you're meeting two different personalities and how they handle equally dangerous situations.
And that was, you know, I love that line later on of like different methods, same result.
Yeah, and again, it that harkened back to me to a famous parkour sequence or free running sequence in Casino Royale.
Yeah,
but we'll talk about that a little later. But it had a similar thing where this one guy, James Bond's chasing after, great sequence, and that guy's methods to get through here and there, and then you got the bullish James Bond is just like breaking down doors and going, you know,
yeah.
Same result, different way to get there. So
exactly, and you know what I loved about it in this sense, in terms of the story, you learn just how much, how corrupt things really were. You know, I loved, you know, we got so many sequences of Lino trying to escape and trying to kind of do something about this. And then, we're right at kind of like the midpoint and, you know, that's when he's captured.
Yeah.
And that's really what brings, Paul Walker and him together is that, oh, okay, now he's in jail. And now we're going to get kind of insert Paul Walker into the equation and whatever else. But it was a nice kind of introduction to see how corrupt it really was.
Yeah. And, you know, and again, you had a sense like I have to point out again, like what you mentioned, the opening sequence with our board of governors. You know, you mm-hmm. had the governor guy and he's, you know, at his board and, hey, we're going to bring Detroit back to its glory. First, we got to get rid of this brick mansions. Well, how are you going to do that, Governor? How can you do that? And like, you know, and he's like, "Don't worry, we have our ways." And that seemed to be the and everybody raises a toast. There wasn't even a question. Nobody said, "Well, how?" And you just knew from there, as you said, that something smells rotten in brick mansions.
Yeah,
and it ain't going to play out well for them. So. I was just wondering when the twist was going to come.
Yeah.
And then when it came and it was so obvious, it's like, bomb.
Yeah, you know, at which point did you start thinking that something, because Paul, Damian Collier, you know, and his father was, you know, that's who he looked up to. That's why he was doing this. His father was a good cop. And, you know, he has the meeting with the mayor and the, you know, people from the army and whatever else. Like, oh, pleasure meeting you. At which point were you like, okay, this is not, you know, he's doing something. He's being manipulated.
Not, you know, I'll be honest, not until.
Well, not until the reveal?
Not until necessarily, like, the reveal. I mean, I didn't. Because when it came out, it was just like. Yeah, not until the reveal, because at that point I had already checked my brain out. You know, it was at the concession stand refilling my Coke Zero, and I wasn't putting two together to say, wait a minute, why is there a bomb, and why are they sending him to go get this bomb? They wanted I wasn't connecting the dots on purpose. So when the reveal comes,
yeah,
you know, towards the end of the movie where. You know, he has to go into brick mansions, find the bomb, disarm the bomb with a code in which they're going to give him. And then when the code ends up being the zip code to brick mansions, you know, I was actually sort of kind of surprised as to Damien's not listening to these people going, no way, they're not going to,
yeah.
they're not going to blow me up. And it's like, well, at that point, it all fell into place.
And I you know, another element, well, two elements that I really enjoyed. It could have been very stereotypical. You had Lino's girlfriend kind of beat upon, you know, the damsel in distress. But they still made her tough.
Yes.
You know, there's that great car chase sequence with the two of them, as we mentioned right before, Lino is put into jail and she's re-kidnapped. You know, she's driving that car. She's the one in charge.
Yeah, Catalina Dennis is Lola. And, yeah, she was really good. And again, that's another Luc Besson quality. I mean, he has a knack for finding, like, really pretty women to be in his movies. And whether they're in there for, you know, I mean, even to the people that the transporter has to save. I mean, the first one had this. They're all very attractive in this one. And, but they're all very strong as well. Yeah. Zoe Saldana and Colombiana, as much, you know, as I dislike the movie, you can't take away that she looks great in the skin tight suit that he has to wear, you know, when she's breaking out of prison. And this Catalina Dennis, she too was very attractive, but she was a strong woman. Yeah. She was, you know, she was a typical Luc Besson character.
Yeah, because she was using her brain, you know, when she was held captive by Riza.
Yeah, Aisha Issa. Riza,
the actress, yeah. You know, they have that fight, but she's grabbing the thing.
Girl fight, yeah.
She can, you know what I mean? So she's always thinking of how do I break out. And, you know, you have to give credit for that. Again, they ultimately, she is a damsel in distress.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, it's well earned and, you know, it just elevates the bad guys that much more.
Mm-hmm. And it also, too, it makes you sympathize more for her and our hero's plight to save, you know, I mean, like, this is a good, strong woman. You can understand why Lino is in love with her. So you get that, and again, I think that Catalina, you know, Dennis, I believe is how you would pronounce her last name. I think she did a really good job as Lola. Lola was a good character. She's one you wanted to follow.
Exactly. and I like
and wish that any diner that you went into that your waitress was as hot.
I mean, is it, you know, just even in that element alone, it's like it's the typical, you know, you try to escape the world, but we're bringing you back into it.
Uh huh.
You know, so you can't really escape. And I'm so glad that it worked out for them in the end. It's, you know, they tied it up really nicely, and they're teaching their kids
parkour. Off their steps, yeah, it was a good scene.
So, and then, of course, Riz's character is up for mayor.
Now, that one made me laugh. I mean, yeah, he's up for mayor. Like, this is a guy who actually has killed people, but yet he's got a heart of gold, and oh, whatever. Let him run from there. Forget about those. Forget about what I did before. Forget about my killing people and running drugs, and that was my environment. I love that.
As we're shifting, you know, obviously we'll talk Paul Walker and we'll talk David Bell and the rest of the cast, but let's talk about Riz's character, because I found him enjoyable. Some people are criticizing him, but I, there was that great scene of, you know, I love about this? It's a recipe. My mom made it. And the great thing about a recipe is if you follow it, you will get results.
Right.
Now, I gave you the recipe and you didn't come through. No drugs, no Lino. What's up with that?
Let's right, you know, all cards on the table. He's no Paul Sorvino from Goodfellas cooking, but it was funny to see him. You know, with that big cleaver doing his cooking, and, you know, he was the typical mob boss, you know, drug dealer, drug kingpin, you know, what do you want to say, stereotypical, because his character does sort of kind of change, or something happens with his character that actually sort of kind of took me by surprise, because I didn't see it prior. I mean, he was killing off his thugs who were failing him, so he was someone to be feared. He was the bad guy. You didn't want to disappoint him, obviously, pardon me. But at the same time, at the end, it was like when he had that turnaround, I was like, I'm not gonna kill Detroit. That's not what I do. I was like, wow, where did that come from? Because he really talked up a good game up to that point, right? I mean, So that came sort of quick, and then blaming the environment, and you know. But then the other twist was he didn't kill Damien's father.
He did not.
He was set up for that, and they threw a lot. You had to, yeah. They threw a lot. There were a lot of layers that you had to go through.
I mean, they weren't deep layers, but
were layers. I mean,
yeah.
Drug lord who has a heart of gold, who had to survive in his environment, and this is the only way he could do it. But he was set up. He never killed, you know, one of our heroes' father, and you know he's not that man.
And the reason it worked was, again, you know, maybe in the parking lot, as you're discussing the movie, again, you could tear this thing apart. But it worked at the moment because Reza, her character.
I just call him more. Reza.
The girl, at those moments when they were about to bomb Detroit, you know, she was the one who was pushing for him. He was like, no, we can't.
Right.
And so it gave us a worse villain to even now root for.
Yeah.
Because going back to the fight scene between between our two women, he was the one that said, you know, play nice or whatever it was. Yeah. And so he
interceded, yeah, too. Like, he, hey, easy, you know, ease up on her.
So that was a good technique to kind of, you know, yes, keep him villainous, but at the same time tame him so that when the twist did come, it wasn't, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even in a movie like this, you can take it too far where it just can't come back.
Yeah. And he had, if you think about it, he had multiple opportunity to kill Lino.
Yeah.
I mean, they had him captured. I mean, he could have just shot him on site, but there was some dialogue where he said he even respected Lino for what he did and what he stood for, and he found it honorable that he would come after his girl,
yeah,
and whatnot. but it's just funny, you know. It's just, I don't know. Again, the drug lord who has a sort of kind of has a heart of gold, and it was my environment, and then next thing you know, he's running for mayor.
Well, let's talk about the other thugs, because, you know, in many ways, some of these had to be presented as obstacles. Like, you know, in order to make the parkour thing work and other aspects, you know, we got a lot of car chases and things of that nature. In order to make it work, we need to create some characters to do so.
Sure.
One, we'll talk about K2, but one in particular, I forget his name, but the giant. George
Yeti, Robert Mallet. is the guy's name, and if I am correct, just looking at him, he's worked. He was in 300. He was in Pacific Rim. He was also in Sherlock Holmes. You know, I mean, he gets his job from his size. He is a big man, and in fact, they even showcased part of that fight in the trailer. I mean, he was part of the marketing campaign as to how are our two heroes gonna like overcome this giant.
I mean, what's funny to me, in many ways, it was quite unnecessary. I mean, if you really wanted to get around the guy, you could have just gotten around the guy. But we made it a spectacle, and that was the whole thing. It's almost like a video game boss where they kept inserting him in, and you know, they got away from him, but he showed his power, and so you knew inevitably the two would meet.
Yeah.
And have a showdown.
Yeah.
Like they did.
And what a showdown was in my favorite touch is they take him down with a big concrete brick, mm-hmm, and then the Tweety Bird sound as, yes, he fell and passed out. I was like, this is the movie that we're watching. You know, no shame, and hey, go for it. It didn't bother me. I chuckled.
Yeah, but you know, and you know, the comedy works from both a dialogue and physical standpoint. You,
sure,
know, how many times, even before that, in order to get in, they had the synchronous kind of flips together and ready, and
sure,
you know what I mean. And so, we'll talk about the parkour element, but there's a beauty and enjoyment. You know, I don't want to say humor; I'll say enjoyment to just seeing that kind of come to life and fruition.
Sure, absolutely.
Be executed in the proper ways.
Yeah, and was I the only one, when you look at that guy, I'm like, geez, if they were ever, with this new James Bond franchise, if they were ever to bring back the character of Jaws, he would be a great Richard Kiel successor. He'd be a great Jaws, this guy. I was going, well, yeah, because he's that imposing. I'd like to see him, you know, I just kept on for some reason thinking of Richard Kiel. Mm-hmm. But he's fun to watch. I mean, you know, he's, you know, when you have that kind of, he makes a good foil because he's so imposing.
Yeah.
You sort of kind of hope he's probably the nicest guy in the world.
The one part of this movie that I didn't understand, what was up with the little tenciled man that he had? Because
that was his little passion that he liked to make little men out of wire? I don't know.
That was the only aspect of, like, I'm looking at it. Is there a greater meaning to this? What is going on?
I just kept on thinking of almost his character in Robert in Blade Runner, who made the little tin unicorns out of, like, bubble gum. Mm-hmm. I don't know what he was doing with those. I just this is what he liked to do.
That was one aspect that was slightly unnecessary. Because then they just brought it back as you know, Paul Walker and David Bell are walking. You know, they go very specifically to that shot of the stairs and the foot as it, like, walks over and steps over the doll. So, fans, if you're listening, let us, and you have an idea of what that meant, please let us know.
Yeah, I couldn't,
you know,
tell
maybe
you.
That was some more greater. So I don't know. I have no. I can't gather anything from it.
I wouldn't. Not in this movie. I would just. I think you've put too much thought into it already. Just let it be.
Okay.
It's just you know. Just let it be.
So let's talk about K2.
Sure.
Because he turned around too eventually.
K2.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But and you know, obviously in the beginning, stereotypical you know, workaholic thug. When they're not killing
Gouchy boy.
When they're not killing people in the streets, they're killing people on the video game.
Yeah, which was a funny line. You know, I try to educate them. You know, he's just the, we talked about it, goes to stereotype. He's the large, you know, he's the obese drug lord, you know, who's supposed to bring your comedic, you know, he's in a sense almost like a comedic foil. Yeah. You know, and, you know, he's the henchman to our main bad guy. Excuse me. And, like, to your point, he too has a change of heart at the end. He's really not a bad guy. He's a lovable, cuddly drug.
He's just incompetent. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that. As they always tend to be, he's incompetent. He can't accomplish. And, you know, the only reason he wins is because, obviously, story-wise, luck has to be on the side of him. And not on the side of our heroes. And so, and what's great about it, every time he does win, he gets a kick out of it.
Yeah, and his plans sort of work. Mm. Like, if you kidnap the girl, he will come. They just can't finish the deal.
Yeah.
So.
And, well, you know, speaking of the whole rocket and the bomb, you know, that's.
He hijacked that truck
pretty
well. You know, I mean, he was. Again, he added, you know, he had, again, another imposing figure for our guys to get around. And, you know, he wasn't going to be the one. He's your lead henchman. And if you went the cliche, the true cliche route, the lead henchman always gets killed off. But he didn't. You know, he's part of the. He's probably going to get a member in the cabinet of Brick Mansions. So.
What did you think of. You know, the only part for me that moved, you know, I was wondering how they were going to wrap this up, and they just went for it. They were like, we're going to wrap this up in such a bow.
Oh, yeah.
When we stormed the, whatever.
City
town,
Hall?
Yeah, City Hall.
Sure.
It was like, all right, we have a revolution on our hands.
Yeah.
What is going on?
You know, yeah, it was like, where did all these people, this many people were living in Brick Mansions? It was. Yeah, that revolution was, and security in Detroit, especially at City Hall, really sucked.
Yeah.
Because these people were just able to overpower everything, and nobody had any kind of weapon or gun. They all either took the stairs or took the elevator up, knocked down doors, and, hey, we're in the mayor's office. But you're right, it was all too, again, I'm not going to, it's hard to knock it. Because, you know, why at this point? Because I've already paid my ticket. I'm there for the ride. I've already decided that this isn't a movie. If I start to really pick this apart badly, you know, I could be very, very angry. But the infractions weren't, I guess, so bad that I cared at that point. And again, case in point, because we've talked about this, why am I more forgiven for this movie than, say, 3 Days to Kill, which had, I mean, again, huge gaping plot holes, some silliness, some character development that didn't make any sense at all, some editing choices that made no sense at all. That movie made me very angry. Where this one, maybe from the trailer, you just sort of kind of know a little bit more what you're getting into, where on 3 Days to Kill, I actually thought it was going to be a little bit more serious of a movie. So maybe it's just my approach in going into this movie.
I think everyone knew what they were making, and they, you know, you can kind of tell the spirit of a movie. And if it's in keeping with kind of what you're expecting, then I think it all works. You know, I think Paul Walker knew what he was getting into. I think David Bell knew what he wanted. They all kind of knew, okay, this is going to be, let's have fun with this.
Yeah.
You know, let's not be restrictive. You know, we're making fun of Detroit. Come on.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny that you say that because in my research I did come across a video. It was a behind-the-scenes video that actually did showcase Paul Walker.
So let's talk about him.
Yeah, well, in that video, he talked about exactly what you said. He goes, you know, I looked at this movie. It was going to give me a chance to get into this parkour thing, and I just wanted to, like, run around, and we had a good time, and he, you know, genuinely, he said, I had a really good time making this movie. I got to do these certain kind of stunts, and I got to work with this guy. He was amazing. And
you're
I just
speaking of David Bell.
David Bell, yeah. And he's like, I had so much fun doing it. So, yeah, they just had, you can sort of kind of get that.
Like, yeah.
You know, so it was eerie watching that video, I have to say.
Yeah, man. And, you know, David Bell, obviously, as we mentioned, brought onto the movie because he was in District 30. You know what I mean? He's an expert at this.
And he's apparently known to be, like, the godfather of parkour. Mm-hmm. Like, he's the one that has elevated it to its popularity, to what it is. So bringing him onto this movie and, I guess, introducing him to the American audience, so to speak, it was a big thing for him to do. You get Paul Walker, you totally understand why you would go for somebody like a Paul Walker at the time. I mean, coming off of Fast and Furious, there's a little bit of cachet there.
And he plays a cop there too.
And he
so
plays
you know
a cop
it's
there,
work.
And they put him behind the wheel of a Mustang.
Yeah,
in the movie. So, and you know that
they play to their strengths. Yes. You know, as much as Paul Walker did partake in, the other physical elements. obviously, they were very David Bell heavy for those.
Sure.
And more so with the car stuff, it was Paul Walker.
Yeah. Yeah, and Paul Walker apparently was so, like, he trained. He literally, you know, he was intensive training on this parkour in jiu-jitsu. Mm-hmm. And even when he went off to Canada, he took his trainer with him so he can continue training and learning how to do all this stuff. And again, he enjoyed the artistry of the sport of parkour. And, you know, it's just, like I said, it was sort of kind of eerie watching this. But I think we would be remiss in talking about Paul Walker, star, actor, and perhaps even man. Now, I don't know him, but, you know of his reputation.
He was, I met him in the briefest of ways. Our executive producer, Maria Menounos, obviously knows him very well. But there was, we were going to a meeting, and he had done something, so Maria recognized him. She said hi. So I only saw, you know, him from off their interaction. So he was about 20 feet away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I said, hi, Paul, or whatever, but he seems like a very genuine, nice guy. I do know Vin Diesel.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously the two of them were close.
Yeah.
And Vin, if it's any indication of, you know, what Paul is like, Vin is one of the nicest people I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I can see why people like the guy.
I think Paul's reputation has been everything that I was reading upon, and Paul's reputation is nothing short of being just a great guy. Really happy-go-lucky, and all the interviews and or videos that I saw in the making of this movie, RZA had nothing but fantastic. He was this great, he brought this kid-like energy on the set. He was nice to work with. He wanted to do his best. And, you know, even talking with David Bell, who said this wasn't his parkour is not his forte, but man, he dove right into it. He loved it. And everybody enjoys working with him. And, you know, outside, I know that he has a daughter, and I knew that he cared for her very much, and all the people that he worked with, he just always heard great things about him. And I think to me that just that adds to the sadness. You don't want to lose a good guy. Yeah. In this business, we hear so many things about, you know, people can be mean to one another, or they're just atrocious to work with. That did not seem to be the case with Mr. Walker. Seemed the exact opposite. So, and hey, the Fast and Furious movies, we talked about this when we did the last one. We dissected the last Fast and Furious. The movies themselves set up a family, and you can tell that they are sort of kind of like a family together in real life.
Eventually you have to, you know what I mean?
But that's not going to happen if someone's an a-hole. No. You know what I'm saying? And so if Vin Diesel and they have this kind of, that same type of great personality, I think it trickles down to everybody that you're working with. And he seemed to have that kind of a charisma.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Exactly. So let's talk about the elements of parkour. Because I don't fully buy this as just that type of movie again because of the number of car chases and everything else. But let's obviously, District 13 is that.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you haven't seen that, definitely check it out. It's worth a while. You know, and you won't be, I promise you won't be literally watching the same movie because it's not the same movie.
Sure.
In many ways, there's the idea of if you plant corn in the ground,
uh-huh,
and as it grows every day, you just jump over that piece of corn 100 times. Eventually you're going to be able to jump 8 feet high.
Uh-huh. Yeah, absolutely.
So, and in many ways, that's, to me, that embodies the spirit of parkour.
Yeah, and that's a great way to do it. You know, I had a great conversation with a good friend of mine yesterday, and we're talking about, you know, because they are billing this movie. They're making, it's part of the selling point is this parkour. And, you know, I truly believe that parkour in cinema has been around since Buster Keaton, Harold Lloyd. I mean, these people, as silent film stars, have always used their environment in one way, shape, or form to escape a situation. And now they did it for comedic laughs, and their inspiration to people like Jackie Chan. Yeah. Jackie Chan's movies, in a sense, it's not the parkour that we know, but if you watch the old Jackie Chan, like the Super Cops and beyond, he uses his environment for his fights and to escape a situation, and he's able to leap from rooftop to a rooftop and do all this stuff. It just wasn't called parkour back then. It wasn't given a name. And, you know, now as we go farther along and action scenes are choreographed much more intricately, you know, now we're seeing it in James Bond movies. We're seeing it in superhero movies where they're using these certain kind of fluid moves to get over a table or through a duct. So it's interesting. I think parkour has been around for a very long time. It just was never called parkour.
And what's nice about it, you know, if it is a movement in this sense, it just kind of lets the action breathe, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it feels real because for the most part it is real. Unlike most action movies that are just cut, cut, cut.
Sure.
Here you can kind of let the shot breathe and you see the action happening and you know, whether you believe it or not, you're amazed, and whether it is real at certain points or not, at the very least, you get a sense of what is going on.
Sure.
And that, to me, honestly, I hate action movies where I'm like, okay, I'm just going to clock out for a little bit because it's just action. I don't know what's going on.
But let's be clear. This movie was not without its cuts and edits. But
certainly,
the parkour, what parkour offers, I think, in my humble opinion, regarding action scenes and what parkour or free running offers is a fluidity. It requires body movements that are almost a ballet. Mm-hmm. You know, they, and again, I'll even point to the Bourne movies have used these things, the jumping from a rooftop through a window, and what it makes, to your point, it makes a steady single camera shot in which you can follow an actor with like a GoPro or something, but you can go from A to B without necessarily making a cut and just go into that window or jump up on a rooftop. And it is balletic in the way in which you can film it. It's visually, it's stimulating. There's a pace to it because it's fast. Yeah. And it makes an action sequence pleasing to the eye. It makes it good to look at.
Which, by the way, some of the shots are definitely sped up at times.
Yes. To make or it, slowed down. Or slowed for that down. Matter. So you
the flips were definitely slowed down every time that, you know, the synchronous flipping and you know, to heighten the bond between David Bell and Paul Walker.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
I think as a cinematographer, you just it seems like you would have a lot of fun with it, you know, and how to do it. Editing, again, I think in that sense, I think there's a lot of options for you and finding the right combination. There's definitely a lot of possibilities.
Sure, and don't forget, too, the other key thing, this is a movie. So you do have as great as David Bell is, there is still a responsibility on the filmmakers that everything is going to be choreographed out.
Yeah.
So, you know, and you still have a stunt coordinator. You still have a guy who's there whose responsibility is to make sure that the stunts go right. So even though we know that this is parkour and that this sport exists and that people do actually do this, you know, in a movie you do have a stunt coordinator who works with the director and they've got to choreograph the fights out and how are we going to make this work, and David Bell brings his expertise to it because he can say, well, this is, I could climb up this wall, I could flip around here. So it's making it look not so much as choreographed too. I think that's another thing that parkour brings to the table. It's not like, you know, not like you're throwing a punch or something. It's free running. You are running, sliding over things at a quick pace.
Which is, you know, perhaps what you're not necessarily doing as an actor in dramatic sense, you're making up for in this because you have to be able to sell that.
Right.
You know, if I know that all of a sudden I'm going to, you know, I have to grab this piece of wood, right? The first kind of sequence, he grabs like the little mini stairs, right?
Right. Oh,
and
right,
he's
right,
able
right.
to flip them and then be able to hang on to it to drop down. So you have to know, you have to obviously have that in the back of your mind, but then you're acting, so you have to take that out of your mind.
Right. And, you know, it's funny because, you know, the stunt coordinator was talking about David and he's like, you know, a parkour scene is all about the environment, which is true because it's how these people use the environment to get from A to B in the quickest, most efficient way possible. And so he was talking about David and he goes, one of the days we're out there, David threw this idea of having this character come out of the window on one floor and swing on a window washer buggy to come in the window on a lower floor. I thought the idea was great, but wasn't sure it could be done. So I had the grips build me a mock-up with pipes, tried it with the Leno double, made changes, tried it again until we found a way to make it work. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's fun what you can throw at it. But again, I will say, look at what Jackie Chan has done. And when you look at his old movies and what he is able to do with a ladder or with a chair, for that example, and I'll even go back to Buster Keaton, you know, on a train, and what he was able to do with just your every average day items and environment, you know, and how it translates to today's world, I wouldn't consider necessarily Buster Keaton being an action star, but in his day, and Harold Lloyd as well, they were doing stunts that had audiences not only laughing, but gripped to their seats going, oh my God, how can they do that? Jackie Chan took that a step up. And now, you know, we have David Bell. We see it more. It's more prevalent in our action movies today. It's definitely seeped in. I just don't think that audiences understand. They may have heard the words parkour, but people aren't going to a parkour movie, so to speak. They're going to see an action movie. And if something looks cool, they're going to like it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's so funny because all these movies, right, Batman, the Christopher Nolan series at least, they made a whole notion of, you know, how the fighting style was different, things like that. And, you know, I think for an audience, it either looks good or it doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, you call it jiu-jitsu, karate, just as long as it looks good.
As long as it looks good, you know, so, you'll have me sold.
You know.
I don't care what it is. Yeah, exactly. I don't care what they call it.
So, absolutely. Let's talk about you know, I as long as we're talking about, let's, you know, the other style in this was the car chases.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which spoke obviously very heavily to Paul Walker.
Of course.
And you know, I thought you knew that it would have to, in order to make it work. And again, you're gonna have tons of critics, but it had to be different than Fast and the Furious. You couldn't just, you know, it couldn't just be like, "Hey, Paul, can you tell us some tips that you guys used on, you know?"
Well, first off, we have like a $150 million budget. Do we have that? No, Paul.
We got 28.
Okay, yeah. So, but yeah, no, you're right. I think it's almost as if the car chases were written in once they got Paul Walker.
Yeah,
it's like we have to have him, and it didn't bother me.
No,
as blatant as it was,
and you had some really kind of cool stuff. You had the van, which was different.
Yep.
You know, because now Paul has to kind of, you know, get up on the car,
sure,
and then take out the cops, and then whatever. You know what I mean? And so that was great. And then you had your stereotypical really fast cars.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I loved, for me, you know, I really loved the way he used the dirt. You know, and so again, you had elements of that, but also, you know, parkour, where you're using your environment to your advantage. And so with dust there, he made it really dusty so they couldn't find which way he went.
Right. And again, I think that the car sequences here, they weren't the hyper-real Fast and Furious car chases. We are more tethered to the ground and using the environment, using the wheels to spin up the dust, which, you know, people do 360s in parking lots, and you buy it, and the car chases, you know, they weren't doing these amazing flips and going over bridges and stuff. They were actually crashing into walls.
Yes, they were. Or other cars.
So yeah, they were a little bit more grounded to earth, and with some great editing and close up. But yeah, they looked fine. They were good, and they played to that character's strength.
And again, that, you know, using kind of the elements of parkour, I think overall, here's the thing, you know, yes, it's very fast paced in terms of the editing, but at the same time, it's still, if we did a side by side comparison of, you know, Fast and the Furious to this, I guarantee you Fast and the Furious just has a cut every 5 seconds. And by the way, that's not even over.
That's interesting. I don't know. I felt that this movie cut a lot,
but not as fast as most action movies. And, you know, obviously just something different off the bat, you know, in Fast and the Furious, you have multiple cars.
Sure.
You know, or you have our friends kind of accomplishing, you know, one goal, going after one of the cars or multiple cars, whatever it may be. Here, we have one car for the good guys and multiple cars for the bad guys.
Yeah.
So it reverses it in some sense. And rather than having the, you know, the thing I love about Fast and the Furious is they can always be driving very slow.
Uh-huh.
Or very, very fast, I'm sorry. Very, very fast. They could be driving 400 miles an hour. It doesn't matter. They still have time to be on their walkies and be like, "You good? Yeah, okay, turn left. Okay, yep. Got it. Turning left." It just make it seem common. And, you know, we talked about this on Need for Speed. I really like that in that movie they had elements of actual realism. Like, if you're driving at that fast a speed,
you're concentrating on driving at that. Yeah, no.
And
absolutely.
Here, you kind of had middle ground of that, perhaps.
Sure. Yeah, no. Again, I think that the car chases in this movie worked to the extent that they were grounded. They were more in the real than the hyper real. And, you know, with this type of a movie, I mean, you can argue, or somebody could come up with the argument, that a lot of the parkour is hyper real, but we know that parkour actually does exist. And if you see these people doing what they do, you're
just
like, oh, that's
just
amazing.
Watch a YouTube video.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, it's amazing. So, I like the car chases. I liked when he got in behind the wheel of the Mustang, you know, and it was a good scene. It was fine. He was, you know, it's Paul Walker in a car.
And then, you know, you had a nice mix of kind of, you had score that obviously elevated it. You're not going to be listening to this in your car, but it worked for the scenes.
Right.
And then you had, you know, elements of like Lil Jon's Turn Down for What. So you knew what you're getting.
You knew, yeah. And again, all of that was showcased in the trailer. I mean, the trailer didn't hide anything. You knew what you were getting into. So if you went into Brick Mansions expecting something else, shame on you, because that they marketed it just the way that this movie is supposed to be. So, which is interesting because this movie, when he passed away, when he tragically died, you know, this movie, Relativity released this movie, and all of a sudden there becomes a dilemma. How do we do this? And, you know, when I found this great article in Variety by Dave McNary, and, you know, he was writing about, you know, when the star of a movie dies suddenly, it's essential to handle the release carefully. And, you know, if you push it back too far, well, first off, if you release it too soon, people might just be turned off by it and say you're capitalizing on this too soon. If you release it too far out, people will tend to forget because so much goes on in our business and movies. And Relativity picked about 5 months down, and they started, about 5 months after Walker's death, in a stretch not too crowded with other actioners, and right before the summer movies were coming out. Now, you know, I think it's with the premiere, they had fan screenings and people could donate and went to Paul Walker's charity, which I think they, you know, you do a really good job. You do a respectful job marketing. You know, you don't want to be the studio that says you're taking advantage of his dying. Yeah. And I think Relativity handled it with kid gloves or with velvet gloves. They really, they massaged it well. They cut up with a good trailer. They made good, you know, their print ads, everything that was on there focused more on what you're going to see in the movie than it did, say, on Paul Walker, yeah. You know, which was very smart on their behalf. So,
and I'd be curious to know if anything in terms of the actual movie had changed, whether or not they took out certain scenes of Paul or perhaps added certain scenes of Paul to, you know, kind of from the memory.
But I don't know. We'll never know. You know, but they did a good job, and it's a tough position to put any studio in when that happens, and how clever you're going to do it, and you know, I think that Relativity handled it as good as the studio could, and they're a small, you know, independent studio.
Yeah, well, the movie, you know, I said it in between a joke, I believe, but it cost around $28 million.
$28 million was the production budget, $48 million for the complete budget, including the prints and advertising.
And so to date, it's around $11 million. The movie has made.
It was about right now. If you're going to include yesterday's grosses, it's around 13. Worldwide gross is about $16 million. You know, it wasn't number one at the box office. Rotten Tomatoes, we were talking about earlier, it was at like 29%. However, the Cinema Score, which is an audience gauge, audiences were giving the movie a B+, which, you know, I think I would give it a B minus B. You know, I would be sort of in that range. I wouldn't be out of that. But it is interesting to note, you know, in this, I wanted to sort of kind of talk about the man and the actor, about Paul Walker, and try to do it in an intelligent way with information. You would expect that people may think, you know, we're going to go to it was his last movie. It's like, you know, when somebody dies, when a recording artist dies, everybody rushes out to buy that person's albums, and they become number one on the charts. And sometimes in a movie, it's almost, sometimes people feel that can have the same effect. And, you know, when the movie, the opening weekend on it was 9.5 million, which didn't set any huge records at the box office. And it did. Talking with a friend of mine, you know, like yesterday too, it got me thinking about his past, his career in movies, and what it meant to the business, to people, to audiences. And outside of Fast and Furious, how many Paul Walker movies, like, can you name?
None.
Seriously? Oh, so not even like an Into the Blue. All right. So, and I guess maybe that's where, like, I was looking at, he did a lot of the Fast and Furious movies. He was in a movie called Takers, which came out a couple of years ago. That movie did like $57 million. Mm-hmm. He was in Varsity Blues.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. He was in She's All That, although I forget who he was in She's All That, but he was in that. Yeah, see,
Marissa chimes in.
Who was he, Marissa?
He played the a-hole guy who made the challenge with Freddie Prinze Jr.
Oh,
character.
My God. That's right. That's absolutely right.
There you go.
But again, I don't think people weren't going to She's All That because it was a Paul Walker movie. He was in the Skulls. But I think people were going more for Pacey at the time, Joshua Jackson. He was in Into the Blue, which is sort of kind of a remake of The Deep. But, I was trying to find – Into the Blue did $18 million. So, I think with Paul Walker, his movies had a modicum of success. But outside of Fast and Furious, you take Fast and Furious out of the equation, and it's tough. I don't know if people necessarily go to a Fast and Furious movie because of Paul Walker. They may go to this next one partly because of. So, it is really interesting. It's an interesting thing to look at because he died. I think what it is, too, with people, he died so tragically, and it was such a shock to the system because it happened fast. The irony that it oozes is just crazy. And when you start hearing about how nice of a guy he was, that's what brings the attention. And I think people now are look at Paul Walker, the man, what was left behind, what he could have continued to do, because people would like to have seen him. He could have done Fast and Furious 20, and he still would be likable. There's a likability in Brick Mansions. But again, people didn't rush out to go see Brick Mansions for whatever reason. So I just find the dichotomy between human being or man versus star power. And, I think that tragedy doesn't necessarily relate to box office, which is a good thing.
Which it shouldn't.
He's been around for a while. He's been in a ton of movies. And he's one of those fortunate people that has had a career. He could be a B character or whatever. And, he was fortunate. And I think that I think what should be remembered is, just from what I've read and seen, he should be known as the person that people really enjoyed working with. And I think that that has come out more so than his quote-unquote star power.
Absolutely.
Well,
unless there's anything else to kind of really discuss, this has been one of our shorter dissections, but at the end of the day, I don't think there's anything more necessary.
No, for his last fully feature film, you folks have seen the movie. Let us know. I mean, I'm gonna think that if you went out and paid money to go see the movie, you wanted to, you probably didn't come out hating it, and perhaps you've read the reviews like we did. And I think it's a shame that some people actually wrote, what a horrible way for him to go out. Trust me, folks, he could have gone out in a hell of a lot worse movies.
There's worse movies.
There's way worse movies.
And again,
Brick Mansions.
Go back to, you just see the passion on the screen. David Bell, knowing that this was going to be his kind of American movie, he gave it his all. I think, I've seen RZA now on Californication and this, and, I think he had a lot of fun with it, and I think Paul Walker, he enjoyed the hell out of this.
Well, let's talk David Bell 1 second before we go, because I told you this trivia, which I believe I found on IMDb. If you go to imdb.com, look up Brick Mansions, go to trivia. So David Bell is not a fluent English speaker and usually speaks with a very thick accent. To make it convincing, his character, Lino, had been a resident of this Brick Mansions in Detroit. And his dialogue, because of his heavy French accent, they say his dialogue was actually dubbed over by Vin Diesel. So I didn't catch that. It sounded like it was his voice. I can't corroborate, but if anybody can, again, I believe I found this on IMDb. Mm-hmm. They can be wrong. If anybody can corroborate what I just said, that would be interesting. But I find it to be an interesting fact when we talk about Fast and Furious and bring it all back into the family.
Indeed. So on that note, thank you guys yet again for if nothing else, putting up with us.
At least, yeah. At the very least.
For another dissection, it has been a lot of fun. Let us know your thoughts and opinions. I'd love to hear them, whether about Paul Walker specifically or, you know, perhaps, you know, just the movie itself. Because
sure.
We did enjoy the movie for what it was, and it's been another great, fun dissection. As always, we have tons of great stuff in the works. We're going to have The Other Woman soon up for you. Amazing Spider-Man coming out. Amazing Spider-Man 2, we're going to be doing real soon.
Godzilla,
X-Men Days of Future Past we got coming. And I'm thinking I'm going to try to convince you guys to do an X-Men First Class special as well.
That'd be fun.
So a lot to look forward to. A lot to look behind. Hey, if you haven't caught up on everything, there's a lot in the archives that's definitely worth checking out too. So don't think it's all just the head. It's, you know, there's a past, present, and future to this whole thing.
Yeah, go out and either Blu-ray or whatever. If you didn't catch a movie, go catch it on Blu-ray and then come back. So absolutely, we're there for eternity.
Anyway, thank you, Marissa, for engineering. Thank you to you at home, in your car, at work. Don't tell your boss. For listening or watching, and we do it for you.
And don't forget, you don't need to be a rocket scientist. You just need a rocket.
And you just need a movie theater to go see the favorite movies.
Cheers. Absolutely.
See you next time.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.